Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. In this podcast, I share observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Currie, who recently joined as Carlyle's Chief Strategy Officer of Energy Pathways. And we're going to have a discussion about the energy transition and its implications for companies and investors. This episode was recorded on April 4th, 2024, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before we turn to Jeff, just a few words about what we're seeing in the portfolio and its implications for investors. First, I think it's worth taking a step back in terms of the policy errors that were made in that 2020-2021 period. And I, you know, hate to use the word errors, but I think when you allow consumer price inflation to reach nearly double digits, of course, mistakes were made. And I think the mistakes were not made in terms of decision-making under uncertainty. I think it's really unfair to criticize policymakers for the response to the unprecedented economic damage created by the pandemic. But I think there was very obviously a failure to mark to market. What I mean by that is if you go back to June of 2020, the Fed's summary of economic projections anticipated that the U.S. economy would contract by 6.5% through year-end 2020. By the time Q1 2021 rolled around, we found that the economy actually only contracted by 1.1%. At the same time, of course, in the first quarter, you had an additional 9% of GDP in stimulus from fiscal authorities that were injected into the economy. So a lot more fiscal policy support than expected in June, an economy that had fared much better than expected in June. But what happened in terms of policy was that there was no change made at all. In fact, the exact policy course that one believed was appropriate for that June 2020 scenario was maintained really through the end of 2021. It was only November of that year that the Fed started signaling that it was pivoting to less accommodation. And the reason I bring this up is it could have, I think, important implications for today. When you look at the three buckets of metrics that the Fed should be focused on as it relates to policy setting, first, the real economy, it continues to perform very well. Areas that we've mentioned previously, largely hedged U.S. households, thanks to long-term fixed rate mortgages, have been able to spend really the same rate of the growth in compensation, which is running about 4%. Yes, it's more difficult to finance homes and big ticket purchases, but most of the spending is coming in the form of experiences, travel, tourism, live events. Our index in March reached a new high relative to the same weeks prior to the onset of the pandemic. When you look at inflation, we don't see signs inflation is picking back up, at least in terms of prices paid across the portfolio, but it's not really falling all of that much. And, you know, continues to be 80, 100 basis points above target. And then finally, financial conditions, you know, the key set of variables that intermediate policy rates and then the economic outcomes the Fed targets in terms of employment and inflation. And there you would have to conclude financial conditions are easier than any time since base rates were zero. So, you know, this guidance towards rate cuts, don't worry, rate cuts are coming. They may just come further into the future. One wonders, you know, how appropriate that is, how apt it is for current economic conditions. And if one were to mark to market, I think it would be a much more neutral stance. And so we'll see, but I think it does, again, provide a strong indication that this is a central bank that is very committed to rate cuts. One other point I would make is that I think most market participants expected a high degree of coordination across global central banks, both in terms of the timing and magnitude of rate cuts. And this also just doesn't really seem appropriate at the moment. It looks as though the European Central Bank is in a much better position to start easing. And I think one could expect even more easing over the course of the year. That's both because the disinflation has maintained a pace that we saw at year end, whereas US inflation, again, is kind of gone sideways. I think there's clearer signs of inflation returning to the ECB's target. And then at the same time, you have an economy that is much weaker. Most of that is attributable, as we see in our portfolio, to the energy shock, to the decline in consumption of natural gas. And then, of course, the decline in output for all of those natural gas consuming sectors, whether using natural gas as a feedstock or high heat in metals, ceramics, glass, et cetera. Also, other economies, Canada, Sweden, where you have much less fixed rate debt, a lot more household mortgage debt that reprices, leads to dramatic increases in the interest expense as a share of GDP. Again, much stronger case to start easing there. Again, in addition to just this sort of curious Fed insistence on its pre-existing policy path, I think we're also going to see over the next couple of months a greater appreciation for the scale of divergence in monetary policy across economies, again, both related to economic fundamentals, but also just the different structure of debt markets and trends in inflation. Finally, the one economy, of course, where rates are going in the other direction is Japan. First rate hike since 2006. But I think more importantly, this is a gradual process of allowing Japanese government bond yields to reset to more normal levels. The exchange rate is still under pressure, largely because those interest rate differentials at the 5 to 10 year quarter of the yield curve are as wide as they've been in many years. And I think it's over the next few months, as those yields are allowed to rise to 1.5-2% at the 10 year, that you'll start to see less pressure on the exchange rate and, you know, perhaps a re-equilibration somewhere in the range of 125 to 130 for the dollar-yen exchange rate. So with that, I'm very happy to turn to Jeff. And I followed Jeff for a long time. His work on food versus fuel in the 2000s, when this was really the use of corn-based ethanol and this demand shock from that and its implications for both food commodity prices, but then also the global oil markets, was really something that had a big effect on policymakers at the time, thinking through the implications of this and the efforts at that time to increase domestic energy security. So again, it's great. He's joined Carlisle in February. So I'm very happy to have you both at the firm, but then also as a guest today. So first, I want to start with, you know, basically your role here and what it means when you're Chief Strategy Officer of Energy Pathways. And I think everyone is familiar with decarbonization, the need to decarbonize the economy and doing that by transitioning to renewable or non-carbon emitting sources of energy. But what do we mean when we talk about energy pathways? Why the use of that word specifically?
Well, first, you know, it's fabulous to be a colleague of yours, Jason. And there's three terms I want to discuss here: energy transition, energy addition, and energy pathways. Let's define each. Transition is moving from one energy source to another. We've never done that before. What we have seen before were energy additions, meaning we moved from wood to coal. By the way, we're burning the same amount of wood today as we were in 1800 when we made the transition or the addition to coal. But a really important point here is that the economics of coal were better than wood. Then we added on oil, gas, nuclear, hydro. All of those were energy additions. And by the way, each one of them had pathways, because you needed to create the linkages from the old to the new. Because yes, once you discovered coal as an energy source, you had to create all of the consumption downstream infrastructure to support that. So what we're talking about now is all the complications of an energy addition that we've experienced before, but what we're going to do is transition out of the old and into the new instead of adding. So the pathways here are wide. And the one thing that I'm going to bring up is the need to be technologically agnostic, because we do not know what these pathways look like. And we have to try things over and over until you find the pathway. So why are we using the term energy pathways? Is to represent the complexity of this transition and the inability to define a pathway as of today. And we want to create one. You know, when we think about the situation, this energy transition is extremely disorganized and nothing short of chaotic. And we want to be involved in creating that pathway that is the lowest cost, most reliable, and least volatile, that gets you from the old to the new.
So I want to pick up on what you mentioned at the outset, just the stress on minerals and what the transition is doing to commodities. You, of course, are one of the most famous commodity analysts. I think that whenever you publish research, it had a market-moving impact. What are you seeing in the commodity complex today? And how does it differ from what you saw over the course of your 30-year career?
Financial conditions are easier today than they were when we were at zero interest rates. And I'm definitely in agreement with you that the guarantee of rate cuts later this year is still very highly uncertain. And what we're seeing right now is a classic late cycle rally in commodities. After you go through the mid-cycle pause, which we could say it was late 22, early 23, the economy re-accelerates from the higher rates. And what we're seeing in the U.S. is exceptional demand pull for many of these resources. China is stimulating. All of this is putting stress on the system. And, you know, when I was at Goldman, we called this thesis the revenge of the old economy. The revenge of the old economy, put bluntly, is poor returns in the old economy saw capital redirected to the new economy. Just look at where the S&P is being driven by new economy tech. This divergence historically continues until you finally see the system break. And we look at that spread between new economy and old economy, we're back up to record levels, which means the only way you're going to solve these longer term problems is through higher prices, higher returns in the old economy that's going to attract capital back to the space. But the hurdle rates, whether if it's through sustainability efforts or through a history of bad returns and volatile returns, those hurdle rates are getting higher and higher. So that's what we mean by the revenge of the old economy. You starve a sector of the capital required to go to the production base, it will come back and have a significant impact on the ability to supply at future dates.
No, it's really fascinating to consider. But of course, policy is really central to questions of energy transition. The amount of public support that is available, made available through the Inflation Reduction Act, similar policies enacted elsewhere in the world. And I'm wondering, what are you watching in this space? And how do you incorporate policy decisions, deliberations into your analysis?
Let's go back to the fundamental point that I said before with energy additions. They occurred because the economics powered them. You know, coal was cheaper than wood. Oil was cheaper than coal. By the way, the reason why the U.S. has accelerated its reduction in emissions is gas was cheaper than coal and everything else on your screen, and it's even cheaper today. And the economics will drive this if they're there. Now, we would have already energy transitioned long ago if the economics were there. They're not. So you have to rely on policy. Now, I want to start with a basic economics 101 point. We know what to do with carbon. It's impose a carbon tax. We've all learned that. We've seen it with sulfur. It works. I don't want to get into the politics of why we don't have carbon taxes and carbon prices all over the world. They're in places in Europe and California and a few places around the world, but they need to be global. And that really sits at the core. But the short answer to this stuff, it absolutely requires a policy response.
What does this mean going forward for traditional energy companies? You know, it is this complex intersection of the economics that are generally more favorable. You have greater energy density, but at the same time, the need to transition, the need to decarbonize, and of course, the policy support for alternatives, but also there can be a punitive element in policy as well for some of the traditional energy producers. And I'm wondering, how do you chart the course, given the uncertainty in these various dimensions, when thinking about traditional energy companies and markets?
Yeah, I like to point out the focus always wants to be on the oil producers. So they got all the bad problems the rest of the world wants to not deal with, but you can't shun it. And you push it to places like China, India, and Indonesia. You've got to own the emissions to control the emissions. And divestment shirks the responsibility of decarbonization. And so by taking ownership of these assets, you're in a position to control their wind down and make the transition occur in an orderly, non-volatile environment. Because all we've done with divestment thus far is to make the world a poorer place, a dirtier place, and a more volatile place. This space is going to be critical to creating that pathway that I think all of us are looking for.
The only way you can decarbonize is to actually own the carbon-emitting assets. That's a really important point. I think we've been through this period of years where people have focused on decarbonizing their portfolios, which has actually done nothing to take any molecules of carbon out of the atmosphere. The situation in Europe, again, when you look at the shock from natural gas, the decline in the industrial sector and everything that is downstream from it. Do you feel that we're in an inflection point? Is this resonating, that this basic strategy of decarbonizing portfolios, which actually just leads to greater fragility, instability in the economy, is this something that you think people are now, you know, really coming to appreciate?
Unfortunately, at this point, they may recognize the uncertainty around it, but I don't think they understand what drove it. There is a recognition that this is going to cost a lot and there are these problems, but we're not at a point to fully understanding what these problems actually are. But the sentiment inflected too far the other direction, but the actual actions, it's like a slow-moving super tanker. It's going to take a long time to turn it, but I think we're going to get there on a more stable path. You know, Jason, you made the point that policy in some cases should be punitive. Let's call the punitive one sticks and the subsidies carrots. Right now, we have a lot of carrots, but we don't have any sticks. And so without the sticks, demand's going to keep going up. It's not a closed loop. You need the carbon tax to fund the subsidies. And the other point is, because of that structure, governments are choosing the technologies. They're not letting the market choose it. And so my one recommendation to policymakers, you got to be technologically agnostic, but you can only do that through the sticks or carbon prices and carbon taxes, because by definition, the subsidy requires the carrot.
Just one final question. So there's no topic that garners more investor interest today than AI. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, Jeff, how does AI play in to energy pathways, energy transition, and the space more generally?
It's the demand for energy. If you had all the investment that many refer to, it would nearly double the demand for electricity. So you need to build out even more electricity production than what we had anticipated before. And the way I like to describe AI, it's chips and copper. The defining constraint on actually creating that extension in electricity production is going to be the copper for the wiring and the copper for the batteries and everything electrical. So I like to point out, copper is the one element that is the best conductor of electricity. It's a superconductor. So that's really going to be the bottleneck.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed our conversation. On behalf of our team here at Carlyle, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us for our next episode of Insights and Indicators.